Walker versus Litcher. Mr. Weinstein.
Oops. May it please the court, my name is Robert Hennick. I represent David Walker.
Oh, excuse me, I apologize. I couldn't say it's Mr. Hennick.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
This is the appeal from denial of a federal habeas petition. There are two issues before the court. The first concerns confrontation, that being whether Mr. Walker was denied the right to confront the witnesses against him when the trial judge excluded powerful evidence of the complainant's motive to falsify the charge of sexual assault in order to avoid another beating by your jealous boyfriend. Second issue is whether Walker was denied the right to the effective assistance of counsel when trial counsel failed to present undisputed evidence that semen was not found on the complainant's clothes, where one would expect to have found it if the complainant's...
Don't I recall that your client's position was consensual sex?
Yes.
And then what difference does it make? That's the only issue then, isn't it?
On the ineffectiveness claim, the reason why it makes a difference is that the complainant claimed that she was pulling down her dress, that the underwear was never removed at the time of the alleged assault. The state construed her testimony as being that semen was emitted under these circumstances, and it seems to me that it would be extremely difficult, if that were true, that no semen would have gotten onto the clothing. Defendant's testimony was that this was consensual.
Why is semen an issue at all once your client takes the position that there was consensual sex?
Because if it was consensual, then the likelihood is that there would not have been underwear on, there would not have been the dress on, so it wouldn't have been there to have the semen fall on. That's why that would make a difference. Today I'd like to focus on the issue of confrontation, unless the court has any other questions on the ineffectiveness claim. Confrontation, we submit, is controlled by the Supreme Court's decision in Olden versus Kentucky. And in light of that decision, we submit that not only was the right to confrontation violated, but also that the trial court's and the state court's decisions to the contrary are patently unreasonable, if not directly contrary to the decision in Olden. In Olden, the Supreme Court held that the petitioner, the defendant, was denied confrontation when the trial court excluded evidence of the living arrangements between the complaining witness and her boyfriend. The reason why that was important to the case was that the defendant there had alleged, again, like in ours, that it was a consensual sexual relationship or sexual act, and that the relationship between the complainant and her boyfriend demonstrated a motive that she wanted to continue that relationship, and rather than risk that relationship, it was more important to her to make this consensual sexual relationship or sexual act a sexual assault. Supreme Court agreed that this was a strong motive to fabricate, and it further held that the asserted state interest to avoid possible prejudice to the complainant, even though legitimate, because in that case the complainant, as the court may recall, the complainant was white, the boyfriend was black, and the state trial court was concerned about racial prejudice against her by the jury. So we have a legitimate interest on the part of the state to exclude the evidence. We have a strong motive, evidence of motive supporting the defendant's theory, and the Supreme Court said that excluding that evidence was not only wrong but unreasonable.
Mr. Hennig, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, where is the connection here between this jealous boyfriend that she would have concocted this story about this attack because her boyfriend would be jealous?
But we have the evidence that not 11 months earlier that the boyfriend had assaulted her. Based on his jealous belief that phone call she was making was suggested that she was involved with another man. So we have the history there. We have the factual basis for the jealousy, for the violent reaction. We also have the fact that the sexual encounter with Walker resulted in either a hickey or a bite mark on her face, something that the boyfriend would see. We also have the fact that the daughter, the 8-year-old daughter, the complainant found out afterwards, had called 911. So it's clear, or it
the
would be.
The complainant found out. The daughter, when she made the 911 call, said, "My mommy told me to call."
Yes. And when she testified at trial, she at one point said her mother told her to make the call. At another point, she said
but
the mother
didn't. But the call itself, the tape recording of the call, says that my mother told me to call. That's fairly conclusive on the subject, isn't it?
Well, it is certainly evidence that the mother told her to call. It's not necessarily conclusive when she testifies.
It's pretty close. I mean, you can't think the 8-year-old girl made the story up that her mother told her to call 911. I mean, well, as long as we're talking about reasonableness, at least we can be, you and I can be reasonable one to another.
It is certainly evidence, and it is strong evidence that the mother could have done that. On the other hand, when you look at everything else that is in the 911 call that the child made, there is no allegation that a hammer was used, although she testified later and the mother testified a hammer was used. There is also no allegations of Walker actually hitting her mother until she was specifically asked, and then the daughter agreed to that characterization. All the child said was, "I don't know what's going on. I hear bumping." Which
my mommy told her to call 911. I hear bumping. I don't know what's going on.
Yep, and that is certainly evidence that the jury could consider.
Yep,
and that goes to at most the issue of harmless error. It doesn't go to the issue of whether or not evidence of a motive is relevant in the case. Evidence, if we look for
this is during the transaction. I mean, it's not something she's reflecting and make sure that when the boyfriend finds out about it, she's going to get whacked. The call is being made during the event.
Yes. And
all she's thinking ahead now that my boyfriend may find out about it, so I'll call the police, then he's sure to find out about it?
If the jury believes that the mother said to call 911, which it could. Yeah. It could also
I'm willing to entertain almost any argument that sounds plausible, but this is getting far afield, it seems. So
The jury also...
I appreciate your taking the case, but go ahead.
The jury also heard, however, the evidence that from the daughter that a hammer was used, heard the evidence from Smith, the mother, that a hammer was used, and acquitted on the issue of whether a hammer was used on the kidnapping charge. They also heard testimony from Smith that there was intimidation, and they acquitted on account of intimidation. There was reason not to believe Smith's testimony. There was reason not to believe the daughter's testimony. The question here, number
one... Tape is a little hard to swallow, though.
I don't believe that the tape is impossible to swallow, no.
Well, if you're not... They would have a hard time ignoring the tape, is what I'm suggesting.
Well, and I'm certainly not asking the court or the jury to ignore the tape. What I am asking is for the court to take into account that we have two different steps here. First is whether or not there was a violation of the Confrontation Clause, and under Olden, there clearly was. That it's not speculative. That's what the trial court held. Then we go to whether it's harmless error. When we go to harmless error, we have... number one, we have the prosecutor's argument in closing that there was absolutely no motive here to lie. The evidence that was concealed from the jury directly goes to that and undermines the prosecutor's argument. Number two, we have the prosecutor's argument at the contempt hearing when trial counsel asked whether Keeler had ever assaulted her, and the prosecutor specifically said that this does tremendous damage to my case. Number three, we have the fact that there is no physical evidence corroborating the prosecutor or the complainant's allegations. Number four, we have the acquittal on two of the issues that would require, I submit, disbelieving Smith's testimony and the child's testimony. And when you put all those together, especially the prosecutor's own evaluation of the damage that would have been caused by evidence of motive, I think that we find that there would be a substantial and injurious effect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanick. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, appearing on behalf of John Lischer, who at the time was the Secretary of Department of Corrections. First of all, I Mr. Walker argues in his brief that this is a contrary to case, and I don't see how it can be a contrary to case, because Olden sets a rule of reason case that seems to me to require case-by-case determination. And when we look at the facts of Olden versus the facts of this case, they're quite different. More importantly, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals identified a rule of reason as the ruling principle of law. So it seems to me to be a contrary to case. Walker has to demonstrate that the facts are materially indistinguishable. And I don't think he can do that. I mean, for one thing, in this case, it's the victim who has corroborating evidence. In Olden, it was the defendant who had corroborating evidence. So, I mean, that alone, it seems to me, would remove it from the contrary to. So we're, I think, in an unreasonable application of. And the question here, the ruling principle is the right to confrontation is subject to reasonable limitation, including marginal relevance, which is one of the grounds for the trial court's ruling, and prejudice to the state is the way the trial court expressed it. It's really more the Court of Appeals viewed it as confusion of the issues. In other words, diverting the question from whether or not Walker physically sexually assaulted the victim to whether or not the victim was a bad person because of might have been having other affairs besides her fiancé. And it seems to me that what the trial court held in this case was reasonable, and what the Court of Appeals held in the case was reasonable, because the evidence offered was only marginally relevant. It did, to some extent, go to a motive. But in the context of this case, one would have to disbelieve the child's own testimony. She testified essentially the same as the mother, that Walker came to the house, that Walker got into a confrontation with her mother, physical assaultive type behavior, pushed her mother into the bedroom. Her mother asked her to call 911, and she did. The 911 tape was introduced. That was essentially the mother's testimony, too. In addition, after Walker left, the mother called 911, complained about the fact that the police hadn't responded quickly, tried to get him to get there because Walker was running down the street. She wanted the police to get there and catch him before he left. All of that occurred before she called her fiancé. And the jury heard both of those 911 tapes. So it seems to me that in view of that, Walker's supposed theory for fabrication would have required the jury to totally disregard all of this other evidence. And I think under those kinds of factual circumstances, it is reasonable to say that evidence was only marginally relevant. And there was some risk of diverting the issues, and therefore the case is one of a reasonable decision. And we have to look, one of the things that the Supreme Court says on these unreasonable application cases is you have to look at the specific rule involved. And the broader the rule is, the more leeway the state court has in arriving at a decision which is reasonable versus objectively unreasonable. And this is a very broad rule that's set forth in Olden and Van Arsdale and all of these cases. They're all the same, to the same extent, which is there can be reasonable limitations on cross-examination. So it seems to me that the decision in this case isn't objectively unreasonable. And for that reason, I don't think Walker can prevail on collateral review.
Well, Swanson, assuming that for the purpose of our discussion this morning that I have a view of Olden that is not quite lines up with yours, why don't you make the harmless error argument here?
All right. If in fact the evidence should have come in, what we would have is Walker's story that he engaged in a consensual sexual assault, sexual relationship with the victim, and this prior incident where her fiancé engaged in physical abusive behavior because he was afraid she was involved with a man. And opposed to that, we have the 911 tape of the girl who called and said, my mommy told me to call. There's a man in my house. I think it's true that there was some interchange between the dispatcher and the child, an 8-year-old child, but essentially the man's hitting my mommy. They're in the bedroom. I hear thumping. And in my view, that corroborates the physical assaultive aspect. Now, if all the problem was that the victim had a bite mark or a hickey, although the testimony says bite mark, and she had to explain that away from her boyfriend, she didn't have to talk about sexual assault at all. The child's corroboration of the physical assaultive behavior would have explained the bite mark. She didn't have to bring up the sexual assault. So it seems to me that in view of all of that evidence, the district court was correct that there was no substantial and injurious violation or injury, which is the Brecht test, which is what's required on harmless error here.
Well, also, I thought it was a question about whether this 9-month-old incident even occurred, how severe it was. There were never any charges that were brought against the fiancé, and you would have been in a mini-trial over what actually happened in that event.
Well, that's true. And the other aspect of the case is that the defense initially offered 4 police reports, and when the trial court ruled, 3 of them were more remote than the one that we're talking about right now, and the defendant renewed that at trial. So the court had already ruled that was too remote, and that it would divert the issues. And then the defendant pointed out during trial that, well, this one did actually involve some aspect of possible jealousy, although it wasn't clear how that occurred, and certainly they were further along in their relationship, and I don't know that they were even engaged at the time of the first incident. But I do think that entered into the trial court's determination on whether or not we would get off in a road of whether the prior assault occurred and what kind of whether or not there was, in fact...
At the very least, the lady needs some counseling on her companions.
I'm sorry?
I said at the very least, the lady needs some counseling on her companions.
Well, that may well be true, Your Honor.
Swanson, this occurred in the city of Milwaukee?
It did.
It took an hour to get a response in this case? To an eight-year-old charging the mother is raped, being raped? I mean, I don't know, maybe the Department of Corrections might want to... I know it's a little old here, but that little troubling event here.
It does seem quite long, but I guess I've stopped being surprised about what happened in Milwaukee.
Thank you.
I'm a resident of the city of Milwaukee.
Mr. Hanick? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Watson. Did you have another comment?
If no. The court has no further.
No, I guess not. Thank you. Mr. Hanick?
Yes, Your Honor. The one issue that I'd like to address is the issue of mini-trial. And that is what we have in this case is a statement made by the complainant to the police 11 months earlier that her boyfriend, who I think she had a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old, the 2 younger children were his.
When do you get past being a boyfriend? I mean, on the fourth child or?
I don't know, Your Honor. The individual. At some points, it's referred to as fiance. Sometimes
I'm an anachronism. I'm left over.
But this wouldn't require a mini trial. What we have is a police report in Wisconsin, as I understand it. It is an obstruction of justice, a misdemeanor crime, to make a false report like this. If she got up on the stand and she denied having made the report, it would have been very simple to have the police officer who took it come in and say, yes, you made the report, and you would therefore have established the motive to lie. It would not have sidetracked the trial longer. You know, it would have certainly taken much less time than the argument on whether it should be admitted would have taken. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Hennick, I want to extend an additional and special thanks for your accepting this appointment and ably representing the petitioner.
Thank you.
All right. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.